2 years ago, I stood on the hill overlooking the new Powdersville High School, which at the time was still being built. Tractors were going everywhere, and we were sweating in the sun, talking about a move for our Powdersville campus that we hoped would buy us about 2 years of time and take some pressure off of us as we were growing and reaching our community. Well, now 2 years later, we're at that point where we have to make some decisions about where to go from there. We have 9 more months with the school on our lease, and that's been a great partnership. It's really helped us reach our community and serve our community in some really unique ways. But about 6 months ago, we really began to feel pressure that we needed a permanent home for our Powdersville campus. We needed a place that we could call our own. We needed a center from which we could begin to minister to all the people of our community. And as we prayed about that, we believe that God directed us to this piece of property where we stand now. We've had this piece of property under contract for the last 20 days or so. And what we're standing in now is something that will probably be called Bowman Park, named after the original owners of this property several generations ago. And on this site, we hope to build in the next 9 to 12 months a 20,000 square foot facility that will be the home and permanent home for our Powdersville church. As we stand here today, there are still a lot of decisions to be made over the next 9 to 12 months. There's still money that needs to be raised. There are buildings to be built. But as we stand here thinking about all the work that's in front of us, we're so excited about the opportunity that we have to create a permanent base for ministry here at a strategic location in this community. None of that would be possible if it weren't for you, if it weren't for your partnership in this ministry to reach our community, if it weren't for your partnership in giving to One Fund. So we want to make sure we take the opportunity to say thank you, and to let you know that God is moving and God is working and God is directing to enable us to fulfill our mission here of bringing the gospel to the community.
Well, it is so fascinating and interesting how opportunities come our way. And so if you're on our Powdersville campus, you know, Bill made this basic announcement a couple weeks ago, but then we wanted to gather everybody and let everybody on all our campuses know that this opportunity has come our way and we're really excited about it. The goal would be that we would be in that facility for our Powdersville campus next year at this time. And because we're going to lose the ability to have children's ministry at Powdersville High School because all those classrooms will be taken up. So that would be the goal. And we're gonna move towards that as quickly as we can. We're really excited about it. At that point, my math is right, we will have Powdersville's campus will have been going about 5.5 years. And so that's about the same amount of time that our church was going before we had a permanent facility too. So we don't make that as a measuring stick. It just feels like now's a good time. Now's the right time. And lots of setup that goes on, and that's a great season for a church to build some teamwork and have to do some things together as a team, but it is also challenging. And so we're glad to be able to begin thinking and putting our mind around a new era and a new season for our Powdersville campus that will hopefully create the opportunity for some strategic partnerships that will be a blessing to the whole community, whether you attend Grace Church in Powdersville or not. So we want to be a blessing to everybody. So, all right, grab a Bible and turn to 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2. We are working through this series through the fall on 1 Timothy. My name is Matt Williams. We're glad to see you. I get an opportunity to lead us through the teaching this weekend. I want to say thank you for being here on behalf of the staff and the elders and all those people who are serving. We're really grateful for an opportunity to worship together and study together. The book turns out to be like your dad having to sit down and remind you of some things or instruct you about some things that you may have missed, and to make sure that you are dialed in on some things that are very important. And what we'll see, and this will be one of a few passages where we'll get challenged, is that is what we're doing and thinking, is that a product of the trend of the culture, or are we tapped into something that's transcendent? And so when we find ourselves in contradiction of the scriptures, either emotionally or mentally or physically, we're actually doing something that's in contradiction with the scriptures, then we have to ask ourselves the question, is this Are the scriptures outdated? Do they not apply to me anymore? Or am I part of a trend that I bought into? And recognize, when you're dealing with world history, you have trends that last 2 years, 20 years, 200 years. There are whole nations that we say now, oh, that was a trend. And so to be able to say, well, this is what everybody in my culture is doing. This is the way everybody in my culture thinks. This is the way the educational institutions think. This is the way politicians think. This is the way the government thinks. This is the way the military thinks. This is the way the world thinks is not necessarily, if you're God, a compelling argument. So we are constantly looking at some of the great ideas in the scriptures and going, no, is this transcendent? And if I don't buy it, if I don't believe it, am I part of a trend? Which raises, I know, lots of questions about how we study the Bible, how we do it. Well, and of course, that's my disclaimer, because this weekend, and as soon as we announced 1 Timothy, I started getting emails from people who love to study the Bible. Like, can't wait for you to get to chapter 2. So excited about hearing chapter 2. I'm like, God has some discipline for you. Like, I don't know what it is. Something for you. Because here's what happens. Some passages deal with something that is very countercultural. And the ability to overstate or not communicate well or understate to try to be self-protective or to overstate to make a point, that's always really difficult to manage. And then some passages have a really technical, difficult problem. There are very few places in the New Testament where you have these really challenging interpretation problems, but there are a few. And we have one, right? I mean, we have one of the Mac Daddies, okay? You got Hebrews. And then you got this, right? These are two big ones. So here's the problem. Cultural issue, and then, or you could have a real technical issue. Well, here's the thing. We have both in one passage. So just lump them all together. So we will work through it. Here's the beauty, though. The beauty of being an American is that we are self-proclaimed open-minded thinkers. We love new ideas, not threatened by new ideas. We're pluralistic. Whenever someone says, hey, this is a new idea. This is different than the way I think. Then we pride ourselves in being open-minded and willing to listen. So for some of us, there will be some challenging thoughts over the weekend that we're going to talk about. And we get to be open-minded and listen to them. So please, no throwing of items. I would appreciate that, right? The beauty of being open-minded. We will look over the next few weeks, next 2 or 3 weeks, at some of the roles that happen in the church. Elders, deacons, some of the leadership qualifications and challenges and issues, and how that affects masculinity and femininity, and how that affects men and women, and how that affects our church, all right? But the bigger question will be, there will be take-home applications wherever you land on all that. I mean, the question will be, do we see ourselves in the scriptures? Can we go, okay, right there. There we are. All right, let's look. We'll pick up where we left off last week. Verse 8. Scott Mazingo was leading us. He goes, in every place of worship, I want men to pray with holy hands lifted up to God, free from anger and controversy. So there's that bringing to an end of the idea of prayer, but he throws in men, I mean mankind, I mean men specifically, but notice the contrast. Verse 9, and I want women to be modest in their appearance. The word appearance is probably bigger than appearance. It probably relates to also demeanor, okay, and attitude, perspective, how they carry themselves, but I want them to be modest in their appearance. And if you've noticed, nowhere in the scriptures does it tell men to be modest. And here's why. Because beauty is something that is inherently feminine, that I would say this, inherently feminine, that God is beautiful and he has downloaded women with a form of beauty that he has not necessarily downloaded men with. The irony being that in all of the animal kingdom, the males are always prettier. And I think that highlights this idea. Except for this group, we're going to find that the women are prettier. And they are charged with managing that beauty. So everybody knows Olympics, women's beach volleyball. Everybody knows that exists. Did you know there's men's beach volleyball? No, you didn't. Right? Because no one cares. No one cares what they wear. No one's concerned about that. Men or women, no one cares. Right, I was at a cross-country meet earlier this weekend, and so when it's done, everybody's sweating, guys are taking their shirt off. No one cares. No one cares. Not a big deal. Men aren't having to manage beauty in that way. And men are keenly wired, and if you talk to a 16-year-old, a 17-year-old, an 18-year-old, they are acutely aware of being visual and able to recognize that beauty. And so they're given the charge to respond well with managing that. And it's not really a negative. But here's the next phrase. They should wear decent and appropriate clothing and not draw attention to themselves by way of how they fix their hair or wearing gold or wearing pearls. And it's not an exclusion of saying, hey, you can't wear any of that. It's saying the way that that gets used to draw attention to yourself. So this is the why. Normally when we talk about modesty, we're like, women, we need you to dress modestly to help protect our men so we're not struggling. Okay, is that valid? Sure, it's valid. It's the way to love your brothers. That's fine. But that's not the real heart of the idea. And that's not the real goal of the passage or the instruction. The goal or the instruction here is around who is drawing attention to who. Is that in what, how are you using your gifts to draw attention to yourself? And so if your beauty is given to you as a download from God, and your beauty is His beauty, and it's there to draw attention to Him, but you're using your beauty to fill your own emotional cup. You're using the attention that you get from people and your beauty to fill a deep need in your soul. And so you dress in a way because you know that will get attention and that will fill you. You are drawing attention away from God and to yourself, particularly if this context is the church meeting. It's when we are gathered together. He says, so this is something to manage. And let's just say it is a heart issue. Modesty is a heart issue. We cannot say, this skirt should be this long, this neckline goes to here, this can only be this tight, look like that, because here's the reality. There's no instruction in the scriptures like that. No instruction like that, because here's the reality, is that in different cultures, you have some things that are modest in this culture that are not so modest in that, and so there are adjustments that have to be made. This woman can wear this outfit and look completely modest, but if this woman, because of a different shape and a different build, she would look immodest in that. But it's a little bit subjective. And so I get a handful of emails every year, mostly from women, about 60% from women, 40% from men, saying, hey, would you tell the women and the college students and the high school students at our church to be modest? Okay, so here it goes. Okay, ladies, be modest. Powerful, isn't it? I mean, that for years, I kept trying to explain it. And so now I finally get to kind of come through on my promise and go, I promise I will. Next time, I'll tell everybody. The problem is most women feel that they are. And so they're not thinking, hey, I'm going to dress terribly or I'm going to try to seduce them. That's not really what they're thinking. So what we've noticed is if something's not exactly right, generally a personal discussion is needed. So men with your wives, you may have to engage your wife and say, hey, that may not be the best thing. Now, she may lose it. What are you talking about? You pervert and all these other things. What's wrong? I can't help you. That's your deal, right? I'm not in charge of you. I'm not in charge of all that. Could you get killed in the process? You could. I will not offer you any hope. I'm just saying, go solve that, right? For our single ladies, you may have to get a couple who that you could sit and or an older lady, and you could sit and talk with them and go, hey, what do you think about this? You might even be from a little different generation. What do you think about the way that we dress? I would encourage our men to get involved with our daughters. Men will do a couple things. They'll neglect their daughters and say, I'm not qualified. She doesn't want to hear from me. She doesn't want me to be a part of that discussion. And they'll just be real passive on it. Or they'll be overbearing and dictatorial. And they'll hand out mandates. No, you will wear this and it'll be this and it'll be this long and this short. And they're completely removed from the emotional process of what it means to buy clothes and to look nice. And here's what I tell our dads when we're at lunch or behind closed doors. I say, it is partly your job to help your daughters look great. God gave them beauty. He wants them to show off that beauty in modest and appropriate ways. And it is part of your responsibility to help that happen. And if that means you need to learn about fashion and go to the mall with them, then you need to do that. Carve out some time for it. Become a part of the discussion so that you're not neglecting or overbearing, where you're part of it. And it is a little bit of an emotional challenge. But God is not against beauty. He gave it. He wants it displayed. He wants it done in an honorable way. Verse 10, for women who, notice this, who claim to be devoted to God should make themselves attractive. Nothing wrong with being attractive, but knowing how he twists it and does a word play on the word attractive by the good things that they do. He goes, for those women who claim to be Christians, who claim to be godly, what they need to do is not ignore the physical side, but channel some of the energy that you would use to make yourself physically beautiful and make yourself mentally and spiritually and emotionally beautiful. is that you would channel some of that energy into a godly lifestyle. And that, now understand this, and this is going to help for the whole passage, is that this is not the book of Galatians, where he is trying to deal with the heresy around, do you earn your salvation? That is not his concern here. This is not the book of Romans, where he's trying to lay down all kinds of doctrinal truth about here's works and here's... Here, in this world right here, where Paul is talking, he is saying, if you really know Christ, if you're really devoted, men or women, then there is no difference between your salvation and your works. And so he is going to speak to us in that way. And so that your works are the same as your salvation. The fruit is the same in this context. He is not worried about dividing these ideas and keeping you from earning your salvation. He reminds us of it throughout the book, but it is also kind of a foregone conclusion. You're not earning your salvation. He is going to camp on the idea you should become attractive by the good things that you do. The women have been deceived into some heresy in this church. And so they are pursuing some things that are not healthy. And he is going to call them back and call all of us back. And he says, let them become attractive, let them become beautiful because they have great character. So that in Proverbs, a woman who is beautiful but she is arrogant, her beauty on an arrogant woman is like a gold ring in the nose of a pig. You should sit at lunch with a single guy as he's thinking about all his options. Because he could date anybody in the world, right? So you got all these options. And when you try to explain to him that a beautiful woman who does not have good character and who's not godly, that she will not be attractive over the long haul, he's like, say it again. I mean, it's like you're speaking a foreign language. So you're saying that she's pretty, but if she's not godly, I won't always think she's pretty. I was like, right. He's like, well, no, I don't believe that. I'm like, all right. He's saying, let her make herself beautiful by how she lives. Because the hard part for a woman is if she trusts in her beauty, and the scriptures have been clear that beauty fades and everything about your experience tells you that your beauty is going to fade. Then if that fades and you trusted in it and you built your life on it and you built your credibility on it and you all your energy flowed from it and went into it, then what happens when it fades? What will be left? Will anything beautiful be left? It's a tough question, isn't it? You got other kinds of questions that men have to answer, but this is one particularly that women will have to answer. And I will say, as most men in the room will say, there is nothing more attractive in a woman than when your wife lives in a godly way. It is compelling. It is stirring to your soul to watch how she lives. And she is kind when she is generous. Okay, modesty, that was the easy part. Got two more phases. They get progressively harder, okay? So that was the easy piece. All right, verse 11. You know you love it, right? Verse 11. Women should learn quietly and submissively. Ugh. All right, here we go. This is not solo in this idea, in this passage, okay? You see this throughout the scriptures, 1 Corinthians 14. In the context of meeting, not like going to the mall, okay? Not in the home. But in the context of the teaching of the assembly is the setting, okay? So in the church meeting, and the false teachers are obviously pushing them to teach and to lead. But we have two words here. Instead of teaching and leading, speaking, he says, let you learn and be submissive in that. Now, let's take a few moments. Remember how open-minded we are? Okay, let's just relax, all right? So for one couple that came to me years ago, sat down, and they had been in some real unhealthy discussions, and he had resorted to whatever tactics he could use. And so finally, he went and read his Bible, probably for the first time, found a passage, not this one, but one like it. And so then he pulled out the Bible and said, look, this says you're supposed to be submissive. And so he had been leveraging that argument. Let me just write this down, fellas. Never. Never. And I looked at him and I said, hey, you understand that passage is written to her, not written to you. You're not supposed to tell her that. That's not what you're doing. And I looked at her and she goes, and before I could say this, she goes, let me tell you something. Ain't nobody going to make me submit. I said, that is the most biblical idea that we've had yet. I said, now you're talking. I said, you're right about that. She said, what do you mean? I said, no one is going to make anybody do anything. Nobody makes anybody submit. No one makes me submit to the government. No one makes me submit to Obama. No one makes me submit to Nikki Haley. No one makes me submit to the police. I choose to do it. And every time that you see it in Romans, in 1 Peter, Ephesians, when you see the idea of submission, whether it's to a man or to a woman, it is reflexive in its idea and concept. It is middle voice. Active voice, I hit the ball. Passive voice, I was hit by the ball. Middle voice, I hit myself with the ball. And submission is always middle voice, reflexive idea. It's something that you do to yourself. So if I'm submissive to anybody, it's not because they force me to, it's because I choose to. And I said to her, I said, if we ever got to a place that would be healthy and you saw the biblical idea of headship for him and submission for you as not domineering and oppressive, if you ever saw that, it wouldn't be because it was forced on you, it would be because you chose that. She said, okay, well, we'll see. I was like, all right, that's fine. We said, but that's not even what we're dealing with right now. We got to deal with crazy man that you married, right? Got to deal with him. Verse 12. I do not permit or let a woman teach men or have authority over them. Let them listen quietly. And so immediately some thoughts run into your head when you read this kind of language. You're like, okay, it's a primitive culture. We're dealing with a very primitive culture, and that's why you would see something written like this. Well, except that the logic doesn't work for you because in this culture, if you want to worship God in this culture, she's a woman, Diana. So you got to go to a female god to worship. She has all power. And then you have to ask yourself, why would this be written if we had a real primitive culture? We actually have Ephesus. We have a very progressive, very liberated culture in many ways, which is why he's speaking into it in this way. Because there is tons of freedom and the breaking down of many ideas and thoughts that God originally had back in Genesis. Okay, then you think, well, Paul is ancient, so he is a sexist. He's a sexist and he doesn't understand the value of women. He's kind of missed it and he's being demeaning towards women. You could say that, except that he finds himself sideways with great Greek thinkers and great Jewish thinkers because in his writing, he constantly mentions women and the names of women. And so names like Syntyche, that you wouldn't know if he hadn't mentioned her, Phoebe, who you wouldn't know. Actually, he probably calls her not necessarily a servant. He probably calls her the role of a deacon when his reference to her. Priscilla and Eudias. And so there are names that are getting brought out because Paul's bringing them to the table saying, look at these women, look at the contribution that they're making. So he's counterculture in his day of elevating women, but it's still a fair argument worth researching. Or you would say, you know what, the context is these women were not educated, hence they didn't have the talent or the skills because of a lack of education. So that's why they needed to learn quietly and submissively. So it's a cultural idea. That is actually a very good argument until we get to see his reasons. And before we do, let me give you this, is that remember the context is church leadership, the meeting, the assembly, and as we'll see over the next couple of weeks, this leads right into the discussion of elders and the qualifications for elders. So here's what I would say, is that when you see teach and have authority, those are actually at their very core eldering responsibilities. Those are the two primary, foundational, fundamental responsibilities and core contributions of elders. That's what then the elders that lead the church. And so teaching and having authority are core functions of eldering, which is different than deacons, which we'll see that in a couple weeks. So that's what he's speaking to, is these folks who are responsible for leading and giving direction to the church. And if we can trust anything that he's saying, he's not simply tempering what's happening, some outlandish expressions. He's actually defining some roles. So let's look in verse 13. Here's his reasoning. He said, women should learn quietly, submissively. Don't let them teach or have authority over men. So then the question will be, why? Are you sexist? Are you primitive? Are you ignorant? Are they uneducated? What is the problem? Verse 13. He actually skips over all of that and says this. For God made Adam first, and afterward he made Eve. So his argument is not men are just, they're more educated. They're Hellenistic. They've been taught. They've been trained. They're more equipped. Men are smarter. Men are better at math. I mean, all the stereotypes that you might bring, anything that you might bring culturally, which would change culture, he says, no, that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about qualifications. He's saying there's a creation order and thus a creation ordinance that he goes back all the way into Genesis chapter 2 and says that man, as in men, have this responsibility to assume that's biblically called headship, where they have to take responsibility for some things. We use the word leadership a lot, and it's not the best word. We use it because we have so many men who refuse to make themselves vulnerable by leading. The real word is responsibility. Adam failed to take responsibility when it got really, really tough. And so men, we say men are passive, so they won't take responsibility. It's not always solving all the problems and always knowing the answers. It's about stepping in and being willing to take responsibility. So it's not about talent. My wife is far smarter than I am. Literally, she looked at me at college one day. She was helping me study for calculus, and she finally said this to me after weeks. Are you trying not to get it? I was like, okay, if I had feelings, that would hurt them so badly. But right now, I got to pass this test. So I just need you to help me. Do we have women who are gifted in leadership? Obviously. Do we have women who are gifted in teaching? Obviously. We'll get to it in a minute. But this role as leader, teacher, elder person, it is not earned. It is ordained. And the simple example is when the policeman pulls you over for speeding and he comes up to the door and he goes, can I see your driver's license? And you look at him and go, did you have a quiet time today? If not, not qualified. Don't be asking me no questions about my license. Better go on back and have a quiet time. No, that's not what we're doing. He is ordained for that role. Now, we want him to be qualified, and that's a whole separate issue. But in that moment, it's something that he represents authority that has been ordained. And we're having to trust that authority about what they're doing with his character. And I understand this brings up fear of abuse and oppression and loss of opportunity. And we've talked about it in other sermons, and we'll get to it in a minute. But that's a pre-fall. That's the order of creation. That's the first reason. I'll permit a woman to teach or have authority over men because of Adam was created first, an ordained role and responsibility. And then in verse 14, post-fall. And it was not Adam who was deceived by Satan. The woman was deceived, and sin was the result. Now, we know from Romans that for mankind falling, humankind falling into sin, that gets hoisted upon Adam because he willfully sinned. But here we see the judgment and the penalty for her is that she was deceived in the process and allowed herself to be deceived. And so part of the consequence shakes out here. Is that she was deceived and sin was the result. And here's the idea, is that, and this is where it starts, the two worlds start to come together. She was given instruction by God and or by Adam. She moved out from underneath the covering of that authority that was supposed to be a blessing for her and a protection for her. She moved out, and as we call Adam passive, we would say about her, she becomes autonomous. Genesis 3. She begins to think autonomously, make decisions on her own, and say, I'm getting the shaft here. I think I can do better. I know I can do better. I'm going to go do that. And so she moves autonomously, right? So it's a core sin for her. He's got a core sin. And so she moves out. And here's what's happening to these false teachers are teaching these women in Ephesus, you're just like Eve. You're getting the shaft. You need to move out. There's something that you need to say. There's something you need to do. There's something you need to lead and control and take over and be boisterous, draw attention to yourself. We don't really know what they're saying. But they're leading them outside of a design that God has created for them. And so here we get to the application point. Is that sometimes people will say, with the elders of Grace Church, why don't we have women as elders of Grace Church? And I would say, there are a handful of passages. This is a big one. Is that part of the eldering responsibility is to teach and have authority over men, and that is limited to other men. And so this is a passage where we see that very clearly. So it's why our elders and our teaching pastors are men. We are trying to passionately say it is not because we are a primitive culture, because we don't think we are. We're trying to say that we don't think it's because we're sexist, or we don't think that women are educated or talented enough. The context is very narrow and actually very clear. Now, is the context saying that women cannot teach or exert authority? It is not saying that. We actually know from Titus 2 that women are commanded to lead, they're commanded to teach, they're commanded to assume authority in other realms, particularly with other women. And so do we need women teaching and leading and expressing authority? Absolutely. We need tons of that. Not just in the home, outside the home. So a number of years ago, we had been going, our church about 4 or 5 years, we had been given on Pelham Road, 5 acres in a building. And it was just our little church and trying to craft it, figure it out, put it all together. And we were doing renovations over here, and I got a phone call from a reporter from the Greenville News, and she said, "Hey, I'd like to come out and do a piece about your church, and I heard that you got given this land and building. I'd love to hear the story." So she came out. I was terrified. She's writing, and she's got the thing recording, and so I'd say something. I'd be like, "Oh, no, I didn't mean to say that," and I'm like, "Oh, gosh, what's going in?" And so she could tell that I was terrified, and she was so kind. And so when we met, we just general conversation, and she said, "Well, I go to church over on this." I said, "I live on the other side of town." She goes, "I go to church on the other side of town." I was like, "Where do you go to church?" And Universalist Church. She goes, "Universalist, and that's the church I go to." I was like, "Oh, okay." Well, I was thinking, okay, we have some very different thoughts about almost everything. And so I was like, "Oh my gosh, I hope I don't say anything that totally makes her mad, and then she writes terrible things about us." Through that whole process, she was incredibly kind and gracious. And she knew that I was terrified. And so before we went to print, she called me. She goes, "Hey, I know you're a little freaked out, so I want to read to you the article that I've written and see what you think. And you just give me your thoughts." And I was like, "Who? The media?" You're like, "Hate the media." I'm like, "The media is awesome." I was like, "This is unbelievable. Who does this?" And so literally, as I rode down the road on my cell phone, she read to me everything that she wrote. And she goes, "What do you think about that?" And so it was really a great, great experience. But there was, when we got to the second paragraph, she said, "There's something, something, something led by an all-male elder board, blah, 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 blah." I was like, "Hey, hold on, hold on, hold on." I was like, "That part, all-male elder board." She goes, "Yeah, isn't that right?" And I was like, "Yeah," I said, "but it sounds sexist." And she goes, "Oh, huh, I hadn't really thought of it like that." And I was like, "Well, the reason is that you asked me about it in the interview," because she did. She said, "Hey, tell me about your leadership structure and elders," and because, you know, she's coming from a whole theological, whole different world. And I showed her this passage and one other. And so her conclusion was, "I see where you get that. If someone thought the Bible was even moderately, literally true, you'd have to land somewhere around there." And I said, "Right." And so I said, "You don't see it, I don't think, as that we're being chauvinistic or sexist, because you and I had an interesting dialogue about it, and you asked questions. I was able to show you kind of the thinking." And she said, "Right." I said, "But when you just read it and we haven't explained it," I said, "it doesn't sound too good." She goes, "Okay, what do you want to say?" I was like, "I want to say that." And so she rewrote it. I was like, "This is magical, right?" Who knew? And it was for the first time then I thought, okay, what we are doing is hard and complicated and countercultural. And here's the thing: we might be reading it wrong. What if there is this male thing that's trying to read into the passage? We're going to be accountable for that. So we got to scrutinize ourselves. We got to work through the passage. We got to ask hard questions. We got to read. We got to research. We got to make sure that we don't have cultural agendas or selfish agendas. And so, for a good friend of mine who pastors a church in another part of the country, they believe the Bible. But when they get to this passage and a few others, they're able to be really creative in how they explain it and understand it. And so they have women leading community groups with men, and a woman might teach here and there in different settings with other men, with men in the room, and that's, you know, that's kind of their thing. Here's what I would tell you. Like, we talk about it, we don't fight about that. I don't feel a need to judge him or hold or press him, because hey, as long as we're clear on the really core things, we understand there's going to be some difficulty here, that people are going to struggle, right? And so, but the big idea is that elders or teaching pastors are given the responsibility to teach the Bible, and when you teach it, it has authority with it to make people move or to challenge people to move. And that kind of exerting authority on people is really difficult to manage, especially with just us humans. So you always want to be leaning heavily on the Scriptures, and you want to be as gracious and kind as possible. All right, so modesty, submission. Now for the hard one, right? Verse 15. He goes, "But women," and this is more technical in nature, "but women will be saved through childbearing, assuming they continue to live in faith, love, holiness, and modesty." So the idea was, the false teachers told these women, "You need to take over the church, you need to lead, you need to teach, you need to be in that role." And then, but that's not really what God has, leading and having authority over men. He goes, "But then women," so here's the contrast, "but women will be saved through childbearing, assuming they continue love, faith, holiness." Okay? You're like, let me just tell you, this is legitimately a challenging passage. There's only a handful, in my mind, in the New Testament that are of this caliber. This is legitimately challenging. There are a handful of explanations that you will read, you go back and study. None of them will fully satisfy everything in your soul. When you immerse yourself in the passage and you just sit there, you're just letting it wash over you, none of them will completely satisfy every single question that you have, okay? At the same time, for those that hold to the scriptures as being true, none of them completely change the application either. So there's comforting. That's a comforting idea, is that we're going to land in the same place no matter what, right? But just be clear on this. This is, take out the word childbearing for a moment. But women will be saved, blah, 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 assuming they continue to live in faith, love, holiness, modesty. Once again, verse 10, what'd he say? We're not separating salvation and good works. He's brought those things together. That genuine salvation has good works. Those two things. And so he is calling on these women to live out, verse 10, good works. And those two things are running together. He is not trying to separate them. He is trying to hold them together. So that's fine. So what complicates it for us, where we get hung up, is on childbearing. They will be saved through childbearing. So this is not the newest new covenant, the old covenant through Moses, the new covenant Jesus. This is my blood in the covenant. Well, for you, this is not a new covenant that you get saved through having children. And so any woman who can have a child is going to heaven. Women, single women, married women who are infertile, don't get to go to heaven. That is not the idea. He is using salvation in the much broader, bigger sense. But it is interesting that he didn't just go with faith and love and holiness. He does bring in the idea of childbearing, as we saw in verse 10. This is being counted as a good work. And this idea of childbearing is being thrown in with these others of faith, love, and holiness as a good work because it is obviously being challenged. We know in 1 Timothy 4, verse 3, the idea of marriage is being challenged. They're saying, hey, you want to be godly, you don't get married. So who knows all the things that are being threatened and that are being challenged? And by saying the word childbearing, I believe, I'm not going to represent other theologians, I'm saying I believe that he is referring to a much larger idea, the nurturing, partnering, coming alongside, lending strength aspect, the unique contributions that are women's to make. I think he is alluding to those ideas. That there is a unique feminine contribution to make. And in this passage, it is being abandoned, much like Eve abandons the covering that she's in for something else. That unique contribution is being abandoned, and she is being called back to it. And here's what I think. I think that when he says childbearing, it's part for the whole. It's a form of speech called synecdoche. And so synecdoche and metonymy are used like 900 times in the New Testament. So when someone drives up in the driveway, they got a new car, you're like, hey, new wheels. You might be talking about the wheels on the car, but you're probably talking about the whole car, right? You're speaking part for the whole. In Acts chapter 2, it says there are 3,000 souls were added that day to the body. So it wasn't just their souls, it was their lives, it was their bodies, it was everything that was added. In Luke chapter 11, Jesus is talking, and a woman interrupts him, and she says, blessed be the womb that bore you. Jesus goes, how am I going to work that into my talk, right? Blessed is everybody who obeys, too. And so she doesn't mean that the uterus, the ovaries, blessed be the lower abdomen that bore you. She means blessed be the woman that bore you. So we use part for the whole all the time. New Testament doesn't. When he says she'll be saved through childbearing and faith and love and holiness, I think he is speaking about this larger feminine contribution. So here's where it's really important that we think clearly. Okay? Even if you totally disagree, if you say, I don't even believe the Bible's true, and I believe that if it were true, this is a cultural idea, this is not a super cultural idea, even if you do that, just listen to this piece, okay? I think he is saying, do not abandon the unique feminine contribution that women get to make for something else, all right, that is alluring. But that, so we got to hold that up. That nurturing and partnering, the azair, all that is great because that's a good thing. But here's what he's not saying that is the only thing. He's not saying that the unique feminine contribution is the only contribution that gets made. That's not what he's saying. And it's just interesting that we will immediately run to these poles. and go, well, if you're saying this, then you must be saying that this is not going to happen. No, he's saying, do not abandon the unique feminine contribution. That would be a wrong thing to do. But that does not mean this is the only contribution that women make. You go, well, if we're different, and we know that we are, because Genesis 1:27, in the image of God, he created them, so they're equal. But then he goes, male and female, he created them. So now we're both created in the image of God, both equal, but yet we have some distinctiveness and some uniqueness. And so then that's going to feed into some different roles and some different contributions, which we recognize have been abused, can be abused. 1910, the age of men, all that, right? We got that. Terrible trend, right? But so there's a uniqueness for each, and we know that the Trinity, their essence is the same, equal in value, yet they have different roles that they play. And Jesus says, I do what the Father says. And then at one passage, the Father sends the Spirit. In another passage, Jesus sends the Spirit. So the Spirit being equal to the other members of the Trinity, yet being having to follow them in their direction. And so in a practical sense, practically speaking, what's being called on is that what women can be saved from is saved from falling into the same error, the same brokenness, the same sin, the same mistake as what Eve made in a very practical sense. Let me give you some questions that I get, and I'll give you some applications. Some questions that I get from very bright men and women all the time. I get just as many questions about this issue from men as I do from women, probably more from men. So one woman asked me, she said this. I was at our downtown campus after the service, and she did her hand like this, and she said, so all these men get to be elders in our church, and women don't. She said, all these men, and none of these women. And I said, well, actually, as I'm looking, none of those men do. Because we only got five. And I'm looking, and none of them are there. And I said, we're not talking about something that's on grand scale. Okay, we're just talking about teaching pastors, elders. Those are in a very unique niche kind of leadership role in the church. It's kind of where we are. When we're talking about elders, that's what we're talking about. There's only a handful of elders, right? So that just helps you kind of go, okay, all right, well, what are we talking about here? So here's another question. So women never get to teach or lead. No, that's not true. That's not what he's saying. He's not saying because don't abandon this contribution means that it's your only contribution. Actually, Titus 2, other passages, we see a number of times in Acts where there's instruction given, men and women working together particularly. There's all kinds of opportunity for we need women leading and we need women teaching. The context, though, will help shape that and drive it. Here's a great question. I mean, a really good question. And it came from a man, which I thought was really interesting. How do we get a feminine influence in the highest levels of leadership of Grace Church if we don't have women as elders? How do we get women influence? I think that's a really good question. We do have women on our staff. Now, when you start a church plant, I mean, it's volunteers and not paying that many people. And so we did have a very male-dominated staff for a long time. But you see more and more women on our staff moving into all kinds of roles, writing, communicating, helping shape ideas and thoughts. So that is happening all the time. But one of the more profound ways is that for our five elders is their marriages. I figured I'm going to be really close here, is that we have the wives of our elders have 115 years of marital experience, which is profound and powerful because most of what our challenges are in our church are around marriages. That's the number one thing. If you go, what's the average thing that gets talked about and dealt with? It's about marriage. I mean, that is the number one thing that overrides church, right? Is how do you solve problems, relational problems between people? Here's the other thing, is that the wives of our elders have 70 years, a little over 70 years, of ministry experience in our church. Now, they have other ministry experience outside of our church and in other churches and in other ministries, but 70 years of ministry experience in the context of our church. And so our elders' wives are on retreats with us many times. They are in meetings with us sometimes. Every meeting that I sit in, one of the elders will say, hey, well, Cindy thinks this. Well, Allison thinks this. Well, Joy thinks this. Well, Vicky thinks this. Here's what she said. Here's an idea that she brought up. Here's what she's thinking about. There is a weighty and powerful influence there for how we have to make decisions. And then the good question comes up is, what about equality? Which I already addressed it. Is that the Trinity has different roles, yet they're equal. In anything, even if you have a society where we're going to say everybody's egalitarian, all their roles, there's still going to be abuse. Abuse is not hinged to this idea. There's always been abuse and there always will be. That is a godly issue that we have to deal with, right? And so I think it's sad that when you go to Washington, D.C. and you watch Rush Hour, everybody's going to work, all the women have to dress like men or else they can't get paid the same and they don't get listened to. So that to me, that's a culturally broken. Women should be able to look like women and dress however they want and still get paid the same, still have an opportunity to work, still get heard. That's just my thought on that. So I think women ought to be able to express themselves how they are and still be able to participate. Because some people look at this passage and open and go, oh, this is about women working. This is not about women working. So I think in the culture, women shouldn't have to look like men to be able to compete. I also think that when it comes to church, men shouldn't have to look and act like women when they come to church, which is what I think church has become. You got to be quiet, got to be nice, got to get you a flowery diary to write in, right? What man wants to carry a diary with flowers on it, right? So we got some overlap both ways. Well, let me give you some thoughts about what to do. We'll recap. The first one was that modesty is a heart issue. How a woman uses her body to draw attention to herself or draw attention to God, that is a heart issue. The second one is this. For ladies, I have to ask you, are you under authority? You're like, well, I'm not sure I even agree with this passage. I'm not even part of this church. Okay, but are you under authority somewhere? Or are you arrogant and dismissive of your leaders? Because here's what happened in our culture, and the church bought into it too, is that because of the abuses of men, a huge trend of men to dominate, the swing back is towards women dominating. So you don't challenge a woman. You do not rebuke her. You not ever tell a woman, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. So you never tell a woman that she's wrong. You never challenge her. You never encourage her. She gets to rule the day. And you find this kind of talk in churches. But here's the thing. That's not true for either of the sexes. Everybody needs to be under authority. Everybody needs to be able to be rebuked. Everybody needs to hear, hey, I think you might be wrong about that. That might be an area of your life that needs to change. You need to consider that. You need to give some thought to that. You might be arrogant right there. You might be being dismissive of authority right there. So we all got that in front of us. But in our culture where men have failed so miserably, you can't find a TV show of a man that you respect. I mean, the role of a man on a TV show is to be dumb. It's to be the one that you make fun of. It's the one that you would never go to for counsel because he doesn't know what he's doing. Thank goodness he has a woman here to pull him out of the fire all the time because he doesn't know what he's doing. He's incompetent. And there's good reason you see that in art because that's what you see in real life. Third idea. Ladies, to ask you, what is your contribution? What kind of contribution are you making? Because you have gifts and you have abilities and you need to make it and find a way to make it in appropriate ways. That honor you, that honor God. And here's what I would tell you. You go, well, I think I'm wired up to lead and teach. We have opportunities for that. Let me just tell you, though, that leading is pulverizing to all your weaknesses, to everything in you that is insecure and weak and vulnerable. It all gets exposed when you lead, and you get pulverized in the process. So just so you know, and I've had a couple other women that I've tried to help bring along in some leadership roles, and we got halfway into it. They were like, hey, I'm out. I was like, I'm so sorry. I mean, I wish I could tell you it's different. It's different. It's like this for men or women. It's whoever you are. This is just hard. She's like, yeah, I got other stuff to do. I want to do this. And then for teaching, let me just tell you, it's humiliating. Because when you're like me, you have to go home to your wife and your wife says, hey, why did you say that? I'd be like, I don't know. She's like, well, why don't you? I was like, it wasn't in my notes. It just came out. I wasn't trying to say that. She's like, well, that means you have an evil heart. I know. Fourth idea. We don't need to shy away from the idea that nurturing is a good thing. Nurturing it's not a weakness to be covered up. And it's not something to say, well, that's all we're saying women can do. It's not all we're saying women can do. But partnering and lending strength and nurturing, this is a powerful, powerful idea. And the polar extremes of the women are either barefoot in the kitchen and pregnant and cooking or whatever. I don't know what that illustration is. I don't know why they have to be barefoot. And then this other one of women have to be just like men. I don't know why we have to go to those two poles. I don't think either one of those are right. And the Bible doesn't teach either one of those. Well, this means women can't, have you read Proverbs 31? She works in the home and outside the home. When the sun comes up, she's working. Sun goes down, she's still working. So it ain't about that. All right, it's about finding appropriate ways that glorify God with what we're doing. So I would encourage you, most of our campus pastors and hosts announced the Azair study. It's a great time to get in the room and think about some of these thoughts and forget old stereotypes and new stereotypes and begin to think, what does God have for me? What are the scriptures really saying? Nurturing is a good thing. And for my mother, she's a good teacher. I've heard her teach a handful of times. She has an unusual level of clarity when she thinks through a passage, teacher Sunday school class, an unusual level of clarity. She can get to the core of an issue, kind of, and then she's actually quite funny in her illustrations. And she'll humiliate you if she wants to, right? And she can go there, right? So she's a good communicator, and that is a great thing. That's a great contribution that she gets to make. But I tell you what else is a great contribution. Is that she gets to teach now thousands of people through her firstborn son, who she took care of, and she got to deal with the worst of him. She had to manage him as a 15-year-old and get him around the bend on all that. And so indirectly, I might even say directly, she gets the impact of all that she does, but all that comes from having a season where she nurtured. And all without thanks, because in the middle of the night, I'm getting up in the middle of the night after she's taught school all day, and I'm going into the kitchen. I'm like, Mom, I can't sleep because you're banging these pans. And why God doesn't strike my 16-year-old body down right there for not being up in the middle of the night and looking at this woman who's worked all day and is now cleaning dishes in the middle of the night. Hey, I can't sleep. I mean, how arrogant and dismissive can you be? But the sacrifices that she made to work, to provide for us, but also to nurture and take care. Not perfectly. She's not a perfect mom. Not super mom. She was here. She'd be embarrassed. Not great mom. Just a mom just doing her part. Nurturing is not something to be covered up. It is a good thing. So this passage hits us sideways in all kinds of ways. And here's what I'm going to say. Here's my last disclaimer. Can I overstate, misstate, miscommunicate? Absolutely. So I'm asking you to go, what is the heart of this passage? What is the big idea that he is saying to us as a body, what he wants for us? And so you pray. As we go into worship, we're going to have some songs where you get to sing, kneel, pray. God, that's the great thing about the Holy Spirit. If you're a believer, you have him living in you. The gospel of Jesus is for you. He's alive for you. You put your faith and your trust in him. You have the Spirit of God living inside you. He has taken away your sins, and now he wants to speak to your soul. And he gets to lead you as a teacher in a way that someone like me could never truly do. All right? Let's pray. Father, we ask that you would give us a spirit of humility. You would give us kindness towards one another, graciousness as we try to handle truth. You'd make us wise. And not let us be arrogant and lifted up. And Father, for where we dismiss authority, for where we want to be autonomous, for where we back away and become passive, Father, would you speak to us? Would you lead us? Would you open us up? Would you draw us to yourself and give us eyes to see and ears to hear and hearts to understand? We ask that you would empower us, give us courage to not follow the culture and its trends, but to be able to lead the culture in a new way of thinking that honors you and glorifies you. We ask it in Jesus' name.